Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 13th of November, these are our main stories. Police in Hong Kong accuse anti-government protesters of trying to destroy law and order after another day of severe disruption and unrest. The Dutch Prime Minister has announced the reduction of speed limits on the roads to help tackle emissions. And the World Health Organization has approved the first vaccine against Ebola. Also in this podcast, the impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump finally goes public.
History in the House. The impeachment inquiry holds its first public hearing with Donald Trump's presidency on the line.
And we'll go to Russia for the curious case of the cat on the airline. We begin in Hong Kong, where the police say protesters are aiming to bring about the total breakdown of law and order. Parts of the territory have been paralysed for a third weekday in a row. Protesters engaged in street battles with riot police in incidents across Hong Kong. Some banks, metro stations and universities were closed, and the authorities have announced that all schools will be shut on Thursday. It was in June that the current political unrest began, with protesters angry at a proposed law to allow extradition from Hong Kong to mainland China. The extradition bill was withdrawn in September, but by then there were calls for full democracy, an inquiry into the police response, and amnesty for arrested demonstrators. Over the months, the protests have become more violent. In the last 24 hours, there were fires and petrol bombs thrown at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and police fired tear gas and rubber bullets. Eve Low is vice president of the Students' Union of the Hong Kong University, and she said the police didn't have permission to enter the student campus.
We are very prepared to protect our homeland. So when we see that so many police officers do not get any permission and then enter our campus illegally, then we will be very angry. And so I think that's the main reason why so many COK students come out. But also some Hong Kongers, which is not COK students, they also come into the campus and then to support us.
But the police have stepped up efforts to put their side of the story. A spokesman, Sir Chun Chung, told a news conference that police had found a weapons cache at the university.
Offensive weapons like electric saws, bows and arrows were used by rioters to target police officers. One may ask, where did all these petrol bombs and weapons come from? Where were they were made? We have strong suspicion that the school was used as a weapon factory. This necessitates police response and the use of force, including rubber bullets, beanbag rounds and tear gas for dispersal.
China is warning that the territory is sliding into the abyss. Our correspondent in Hong Kong is Robin Brandt.
Well, to be honest, it's a fairly surreal scene in front of me. I'm on the race track, the athletics racing track at the heart of Chinese University here in Hong Kong. This was the place last night when we saw that kind of almost medieval image of police and protesters facing also over a bridge with a raging fire separating them. But now, incredibly calm, and what I have in front of me is dozens of people throwing plastic bottles full of water to each other. It looks to me like a kind of a training session on how to throw petrol bombs, to be honest. To the left is a crowd of 300 or 400 having some kind of a meeting. It's very calm, lots of people on the stand that overlooks the athletics track here. No sense really of an impending expectation of any kind of confrontation with the police, but believe me, as we've seen when we walked into the university campus a couple of hours ago, you go through a kind of an impromptu checkpoint set up by the protesters. They're checking bags, looking for spies, I'm told. There's a lot of preparation, a lot of petrol bombs, a lot of food, a lot of supplies. They say they don't want a confrontation with the police, but they are prepared for one. I think the atmosphere will really change here if the police do try and kind of retake that bridge, which is a few hundred yards from where I'm standing at the moment.
And after the police action last night, I mean, the university had been off limits to the police, hadn't it? Why did they change that policy?
Well, they said that some of the protesters, some of them students, not all students, had commandeered a bridge on the edge of the campus over a highway, and they had been throwing bricks and other dangerous items down onto passing traffic underneath, and that was dangerous, a crime, and they sought to go in and stop it. They clearly have jurisdiction here if they believe a crime is taking place, but it was a provocative move. On the whole, they haven't done that in the past, but yesterday they essentially raided this campus here, and where I'm standing now, there was multiple tear gas canisters being fired and students, protesters running away, trying to get away from the smoke. I mean, there's definitely been an escalation this week. We're seeing repeated daily protest demonstrations, arrests during the working week. We haven't really seen that before, so things have changed.
Robin Brandt in Hong Kong. The Netherlands is to cut the daytime speed limit on roads to 100 kilometres per hour. Our Europe regional editor Mike Sanders told us why.
Basically because of a court ruling in May by the Council of State, which said that under the current Dutch regulations on planning permission and farming, the Netherlands would breach its EU statutory limits on emissions of things like nitrous oxide and ammonia. Now, that put the government into a bit of a whirl because they were planning to build 76,000 new homes next year, and because of the emissions that would be produced in that project, they had to put all that on hold while they figured out a way to reduce the emissions and kind of get below the ceiling. So that's what they've done today. So this idea of reducing the speed limit to 100 kilometres per hour on the roads.
But only during the daytime.
Only during the daytime, because I guess they realise this is a very unpopular measure. I mean, Mark Rutte, the Prime Minister, admitted as such. He said, I don't really want to have to do this. But conversely, if these projects are not allowed to go ahead, then people are going to be losing their jobs by Christmas. And I couldn't look myself in the mirror were that to happen. I mean, the critics of the measure say the biggest housing need is in the Randstad, which is Rotterdam, Amsterdam, The Hague and Utrecht. And there are only a few 130 kilometre per hour roads that go through there in the first place. So reducing it to 100 isn't going to make much difference in those areas.
That was Mike Sanders. The World Health Organization has approved the world's first ever vaccine against Ebola. The drug, which is manufactured by the American pharmaceutical company Merck, has been in use since last year as an experimental vaccine in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Anne Soy reports.
This is a major step forward. It means the world now has the first ever drug to prevent Ebola. A WHO pre-qualification is granted only after a drug passes important safety and efficacy tests. But this vaccine has already been in use since last year to contain two outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The government there invoked compassionate protocols to allow its use while research was still underway. And it is evidence collected during that time that has convinced regulators that it is safe and effective against Ebola. The vaccine will be available in the market from around mid-next year.
That was Anne Soy in Nairobi. To the US now, where at the time of recording this podcast, Congress is about to start the first open hearings as part of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The political temperature in Washington has been rising ever since the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi formally announced the start of the investigation into the president's alleged wrongdoing in dealing with Ukraine. Our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue explained who we're expecting to hear from today.
We're getting two witnesses today, Jackie. That's William Taylor, who's the sort of current acting ambassador to Ukraine. And we're also getting a man called George Kent, who's a State Department official, sort of lifelong Foreign Service employee, who has responsibility for that part of the world, but back here in Washington. And both of those are very key to this inquiry, particularly William Taylor, because he was moved into Ukraine when the former ambassador was ousted, the Democrats, by Donald Trump and his colleagues at the White House. And William Taylor became increasingly concerned about the linkage of security assistance to the investigation into the Bidens. And he said at one point in a text message to one of the other players, it's crazy. It's crazy, he said, to link security assistance to domestic political gain. So he'll be absolutely central to this inquiry, and Democrats will be wanting a narrative out of him today.
And the impeachment inquiry has been going on behind closed doors for a little while now. Just how significant a step is this that the proceedings now will be in public, will be televised?
Well, I think this is a good point, because this is the box office moment, isn't it? We've, as you say, we've had these something like 15 people testify behind closed doors. Many of those testimonies have been released. So we know what these people think. The issue now is seeing them in, you know, in flesh and bone, saying this stuff about the president, acting ambassadors, saying stuff about the president, that he tried to put pressure on Ukraine in return for domestic political gain. So that's the sort of thing that I think will give it power. That's the sort of thing that Democrats certainly hope will grasp the American public's attention in a way that it hasn't quite grasped it yet, but they will see this as a, you know, a television as the most powerful medium and the way to do that.
And just to take a little step back from the detail, just remind us of the process of this inquiry.
So what you've had is the behind closed doors hearings. We'll now get public hearings this week and another 8 people giving public hearings next week. We may get more than that. Eventually, the Democrats will decide whether or not to draw up articles of impeachment. They are effectively charges. They go through another committee. Then they're voted on the floor of the House of Representatives. If the House of Representatives votes for one or more articles of impeachment, then you get a trial in the Senate. So this is a political trial, effectively. The senators become jurors. It's overseen by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And in order to convict a president, in other words, to remove a president in that trial process, you need 2/3, 67 senators, to vote for those articles of impeachment. That would require 20 Republicans to switch side, which there's no sign of at the moment.
That was Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Now to Venice. Sounds of flood warnings from the city of Venice in Italy, where residents are dealing with a series of very high tides. On Tuesday night, the waters rose to their highest level in 50 years, flooding more than 90% of the city's streets. The mayor, Luigi Brugnaro, says the unusually high flood levels, or acqua alta, are the result of climate change and will leave a permanent mark on Venice. He's declaring a state of disaster. There's been another high tide on Wednesday morning, and more are predicted over the next few days. Sebastian Fagarazzi, a journalist in Venice, told us more about how he and other residents are coping.
Within 2.5 hours, everything was gone. When you live on the ground floor, or if you have a shop, when it's a tide like yesterday, it's tragic, it's dramatic, because everything gets destroyed the moment it is touched by the salt water. That's what happened to us. That's what happened to hundreds of shops around Venice.
And living on the ground floor, as you and your partner do, you obviously are used to the notion of high water, of floods. How do you cope with it?
The way floodings occur, they're caused by three factors. So it's like the air pressure, it's the intensity of the wind, and it's the moon phase. So they can sort of be predicted. And therefore, Venetians get alarms and signals. So we have the time to prepare for them. When that happens, when we get the signals, when we get the SMS, the emails and whatsoever, we start lifting our things. So we put our fridges on bricks. We take benches, cheap benches, and we put everything we can fit on top of them. When a tide is as high as the one from yesterday, there's nothing you can really do. It's the first time that a tide is this high in the past 50 years. So we really hope that there's going to be some sort of economical financial help. Because what unfortunately happens in Venice is that people often talk about changing things, say with the cruise ships, because maybe there was a big accident that draw the attention to the problem. But then after already 5 days, I'm not saying months, nothing changes. Nothing is done to help the Venetians. So we really don't know what is ahead of us, if we're going to get any sort of financial help.
Sebastian Fagarazzi in Venice. Still to come in this podcast.
Books on LGBTQ issues, gun control, immigration, even a book on women's suffrage was hidden.
The mystery of the disappearing literature in Idaho. Philippines ranks as the third worst plastic polluter of the seas. One of the key problems is the single-use plastic sachets used by families living below the poverty line because they can't afford full-sized plastic bottles of household products. According to one study, it's estimated that the country consumes 163 million of these micro-sachets a day. Many of the waste packets end up in the country's already polluted waterways. Our Philippines correspondent, Howard Johnson, went to see one.
It's 8 a.m. and 13-year-old Raniel Mirador is getting ready for the day ahead. He's washing in a cramped wooden hut built onto the side of a bridge. But Raniel is not going to school today. Instead, he scrambles down bamboo scaffolding to a raft made up of the parts of old fridge doors. It's floating on a heavily polluted river, Raniel's workplace.
I'm standing on a bridge overlooking Estero de Vitas. That means estuary of life. But the name couldn't be further from the truth because this river is biologically dead. It's full of human fecal matter. It's got lots of plastic on the surface. I'm looking at a section here that's completely, from one side of the river to the other, clogged with plastic. I can see single-use sachets, takeaway cartons, bottles. There's even a child's flip-flop. But it's collected by locals and they exchange it for money.
Raniel has been scavenging for recyclable waste since he was 8 years old.
I search for mixed plastic that is worth money and pieces of metal. I earn around $1.50 a day. Sometimes I get nearly $3.
With Raniel's meager earnings, he and his mother Jennifer walk to the local Sari Sari grocery shop. Behind the counter are numerous strips of brightly coloured plastic sachets hanging from a piece of string. These micro-sized packages of goods like shampoo and toothpaste are a pay-as-you-go option for families living under the poverty line. The area around Raniel's home in Tondo is heavily littered with these small sachets. Jennifer says they're not worth as much as other types of plastic, so are routinely thrown out. Rubbish in Estero de Vitas flows directly into the Bay of Manila and out to sea. And you don't have to look far to see that plastic pollution is a major problem for the country.
So I'm here in Tondo next to Smoky Mountain, an old rubbish dump that's about three stories tall. I can see a wall of plastic covered in vegetation. And today there is a scheme teaching people here how to recycle plastics in a more sustainable way. I'm at the Collect Kilo Kita initiative this morning. What that means is collect waste, weigh it, and earn from it. And at the moment, there are various politicians and businessmen on the stage. But behind the crowd, I can see some weighing scales. And later, members of the local community will bring their rubbish here, weigh it, and in return, they will be given more plastic sachets. So in return for bringing plastic, they're going to gain more plastic to put back into the community.
The scheme is backed by the household goods company Unilever, which has been identified as one of the biggest sources of plastic pollution by the charity Break Free from Plastic. I spoke with Unilever Philippines chairman Benji Yap at the event.
These are people who have been educated to make sure that they are collected back.
So as things stand, the pay-as-you-go plastic option will continue for Unilever?
The pay-as-you-go plastic will be, we will seek to reduce them on and on every year.
Back on Estero de Vitas, it's business as usual for Raniel. Gasping for air, he resurfaces after diving to the bottom of the river to retrieve a plastic pipe he found with his feet. His badly scarred legs tell the tale of the dangers that lurk beneath in the jet-black water.
It's hard to be a kid here. Even if it's dirty, you need to scavenge. Even if it is smelly, you still need to scavenge to have money.
That report was by Howard Johnson in the Philippines. The library in Coeur d'Alene in the US state of Idaho has become the setting for a whodunit. Staff there say publications about what might be termed progressive politics and critical of President Trump keep wandering far from their correct spots on the shelves. The phantom book mover has even left a note for the library's director, Bette Amon, telling her, "I am going to continue hiding these books in the most obscure places I can find to keep this propaganda out of the hands of young minds." So what's going on? Ms. Amon gave this account to Lawrence Pollard.
Hidden books are those critical of the Trump administration, but we've also found books on LGBTQ issues, gun control, immigration, even a book on women's suffrage was hidden.
Right, so there's a bit of a pattern. There isn't any sense that someone is building their own progressive library at home.
No, because we're finding most of them.
Ah, so what's happened to them?
Well, they get hidden in the fiction section or reshelved in the wrong Dewey Decimal classification. They're just scattered hither and yon.
I guess for a librarian that must be deeply frustrating when your numbers don't tally up. I can't imagine anything worse. Where do they hide them? How do you hide books in a library?
Well, if you, librarians keep books, like they call it edging, and they keep them on the edge of the shelf so they look nice. So there's a gap between the back of the books and the end of the shelf, and that's where they're hiding them, an area where you can't see readily.
That's fiendish. I really hope that we haven't given anyone any ideas.
Me too.
So you're pretty sure that there is obviously a profile to the books. These are kind of progressive books. Is there a direct accusation? Do you have an idea of who is doing this at all?
We don't know. We haven't caught anybody in the act.
I guess basically what's being alleged here is you buy books with a progressive bias, do you?
We buy books with all kinds of biases. You know, there's a saying that a good library has something in it to offend everyone, and we're pretty proud that we fit that criteria. We have books serving a diverse community.
So if the phantom book hider wanted to, he or she could find books that they would find themselves sympathetic to, really?
Yes, yes. In fact, once the books are recovered, they may be shelved next to a book that's very much pro-President Trump, and that's the case.
There aren't there, just as a final point, there are horrible places and instances and people who damage books. You know, the great line, if you start burning books, you end up burning people. There's something wrong about attacking books and what they represent. This person is obviously angry, but in an odd sense, they're kind of gentle as well, aren't they? Are they guilty of anything? What can you do them for if you catch them red-handed?
Well, I could say, you know, you're costing us a lot in staff time and taxpayer money, and it needs to stop. If it happens again, you're going to be trespassed from the library, which to me is the ultimate punishment.
What could be worse than having your library card taken away?
That's right.
Absolutely nothing. That was Bette Amon in Idaho. Now to the curious case of a cat body double that cost a Russian man his frequent flyer status and air miles. Mikhail Galin was told that his pet cat Victor was too heavy to go on a connecting flight, so he borrowed another, slimmer cat to present at check-in. But he was caught out after posting a picture on Facebook of Victor aboard the plane with a glass of sparkling wine. The carrier Aeroflot then stripped him of his flying privileges. Our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg has been following the story.
Mikhail Galin tried to check his portly puss Victor onto this flight. And when the Aeroflot check-in lady told him that, sorry, your cat's 10 kilograms, that's 2 kilograms too heavy to be in the cabin, Victor got very Mikhail got very upset.
I don't suppose Victor was thrilled, to be fair.
No, because 8 hours in the hold on the way to Vladivostok, I mean, who wants to be in the hold for 8 hours? Particularly since Victor had a troublesome flight from Riga to Moscow. So then came the plan to switch the cats, to find a slimline cat for check-in. Then the switch was made and Victor flew and everything was fine until the Facebook post admitting the deception. Aeroflot, it seems, does not have a sense of humour and has taken out its anger against Mikhail, taking away all his hard-earned Aeroflot air miles. And that has sparked such a reaction on social media here, a huge outpouring of sympathy for Mikhail and his cat, people offering to give them their air miles, hashtag VictorFly, images of flying cats and all that kind of thing. And even today, a Russian MP, the head of the State Duma Environmental Committee, has written to Aeroflot asking for a change of rules, asking for the regulations regarding animals to be softened.
So all sorts of people weighing in there. See what I did there?
Very good.
Thank you. So is Aeroflot showing any signs of relenting?
Aeroflot says basically rules are rules, and Mikhail broke the rules. And I spoke to Mikhail, actually, got through to him on the phone in Vladivostok today, and he admits, yes, he broke the rules. He concedes that. He says that Aeroflot was quite right to punish him. But he does say, well, Aeroflot could have been a little bit more flexible. I mean, after all, Victor the cat was only 2 kilograms overweight. And he says it's not because he overfed the cat. He's just that kind of cat, really.
Just big-boned.
Big-boned. Not a catastrophe.
That was Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. And if you have any complaints you'd like to make about those puns, send them directly to him. He's at BBC Steve R on Twitter. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Now, I do want to hear from you in anticipation of this year's Happy News Pod. If anything really lovely has happened to you this year, or you've achieved something marvellous and you're thrilled and delighted about it, record yourself, just on your phone, nothing fancy, one sentence saying who and where you are and what your happy thing is. Then email it to the usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you might make it into the podcast yourself. And even if you don't, it's bound to cheer me up, and that's the main thing. You can also use that address for anything else you want to tell us too. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.